Okay.
All right, then let's kick it off. Welcome, everyone, to Season 3, Episode 4 of That's Not What Andrea Told Me. I am Casey.
And I'm Andrea.
Today, we are going to be doing the second part of our Women's History Month episode. So Episode 3 was on First Wave Feminism. We stopped there. So today, we will pick up the torch, I assume, with Second Wave Feminism.
That is a great guess, Casey. And do you want to talk a little bit about how we got off track with our three on the threes?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So we had a guest that we were really excited to try and get lined up for the podcast. We have just not been able to get schedules to align. So we're going to pivot, change what we were going to talk about, and probably have a different guest. So it will be three on the fives just this time.
That's right.
But that's okay.
All right. Lucky for us, where we were getting messed up is my area of expertise. So,
Well, all right. Let's hear what you've got for us today.
Okay. So when we left off in part one, women had achieved the right to vote. And we had, we had Alice Paul pursuing the Equal Rights Amendment, which we will talk a little bit about, I think. Now I'm questioning whether or not I have that in these slides, but that's okay. And I mentioned this in the first episode, but I do teach an entire 15-week class on this. So trying to condense it to two podcast-worthy episodes is really challenging. So if people notice glaring holes and you're like, oh, I would like to hear more about, say, the Equal Rights Amendment, and just let us know. We'd be happy to talk more about those things. So at the end of First Wave Feminism, everybody sort of scattered to different causes, right? And so we sort of lost that unifying goal of the right to vote. And everyone sort of went off to equal pay, equal rights amendment, additional progressive like labor reforms around hours and things like that. And so the progress really stalled between the 1920s and the 1950s. And that was in part due to the lack of a unification of goals, but also due to the Great Depression and World War II. Right? So we had some other things ongoing that sort of distracted us. But what's, I think, really important to talk about is that women getting the right to vote did absolutely nothing to change women's economic dependency on men. Mm-hmm. And so there had been this idea that getting the right to vote would fundamentally change society. And people that were for women having the right to vote and people who were against it thought that, right? That it was going to upend society as we knew it. But marriage remained the defining element of what we would call women's civic status until the 1970s. So do you remember in the last episode, I talked about my professor, Gretchen Ritter?
Mm-hmm.
So she wrote a phenomenal book called The Constitution as a Social Design. Mm-hmm. And it's all about how the Constitution has really defined relationships. And she makes an interesting distinction between your citizenship and your civic status. So citizenship is easy. Are you a citizen or are you not, right? Mm-hmm. Now, we looked at a couple of cases last time where it was not super clear, right? But your civic status is, it's all the other stuff that today in 2024, we don't really think about. So we're going to talk about a few of those things, about how not having civic status or being a non-legal entity, why that matters, and especially how that mattered for women. So it wasn't until 1922 that our government determined that a woman could keep her American citizenship if she married a foreign national. So think about that. Until 1922, if you married someone who was not an American citizenship, you as a woman lost your American citizenship. Crazy?
It is crazy because I also assume you didn't just gain the citizenship of your partner.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know all the nitty gritty of that, but I agree. I can't imagine it just was a flick of a switch, right?
Yeah.
But here's what's interesting. That was the case in 1922, provided you did not marry an Asian man.
Ah, okay.
It wasn't until 1931 that you could keep your citizenship even if you married someone who was of Asian heritage.
Interesting.
Yeah. That ties into a lot of other panic around Chinese immigration and other issues that we could talk about at a later date. I also teach an entire class called The Politics of Sin about how we start to prohibit substances, particularly when they are attached to somebody who is considered a newcomer, right?
Yeah.
And then this one, people are probably going to be like, oh, I wish it was still the case, but that I disagree. Right. It wasn't until 1973 that women could serve on juries in all 50 states.
And I thought that was really interesting, since that was a cornerstone of the franchise movement, was let us do our civic duty.
Exactly.
It's interesting that that was kind of just left out.
Yeah. Now, it was state by state. So I do not know when the very first state started to allow women. It might have been in the 1920s, but it's 73 is when everybody got on board. Like, yeah. I mean, not only is it a cornerstone of like, let us do our civic duty, but this is also a constitutional responsibility, right? Right? That you are entitled to a jury of your peers.
Right.
And we have been quite spotty. We have a very spotty record on giving people a jury of their peers in a myriad of ways.
Yeah.
So do your civic duty, everybody. You get jury duty, you're lucky. You know, our dad, he texts me every time he gets jury duty, which is about every other minute.
Yeah.
And I'm always like, oh man. Because I had lived here for 8 years and I've never even gotten a summons.
That is so interesting.
I know. People in Montevallo don't seem to get summonses. And I don't know why that is.
Yeah.
So
I've been summoned, I think, 3 times since I've lived in San Antonio.
And you got to serve on a jury.
I did get to serve the last time.
God. You, I
it
just.
It was a good one.
I know. Oh, my gosh. I just am so jealous.
You know, I was also a jury foreman. Because I've went around.
Yeah. No, I love that very much. I love that German for you. Okay. Then it's not until 1974 that women are allowed to get credit in their own names rather than in their husband's names. So think about that. In 1974, our parents were alive. Our grandparents were alive. Lots of other people were alive. That's nuts, right?
It is really nuts. And so if you were not married, you just couldn't get credit.
Yeah, exactly. Or you remember we started off this pot, the first episode, talking about that principle of coverture.
Right.
So, yeah. So then you could
your dad's.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Your closest male relative. Yeah. But, and I don't know that people recognize, you know, we're not just talking about credit card. We're talking about homes.
Yeah.
We're talking about any kind of a loan. Right. So you can think about the ramifications if someone is, say, trying to leave a marriage. You know, and you can't. You're really, really financially trapped up until 1974 and even beyond, right? Yeah. Tell your car story.
Well, yeah. So in 2021, we realized we were going to have our third baby. We then needed to get a bigger car because if you need 3 kids in car seats, it's really hard to fit them across a back seat.
Yes.
Even I had an SUV already, but you really can't fit 3 car seats comfortably, and fitting kids in and out is the problem.
Yeah.
So we needed to get a car with a third row. So I test drove a few things. And then I decided to go to the Volvo dealership. I had a Volvo before to buy the XC90. So I go in, I test drive it, and I'm like, okay, I think I'm going to move forward with this, but I want to order a car. Like, I have a specific thing I want, and so I need to order it. And they asked me to leave and come back with my husband. And I was like, but I am buying the car.
Yeah.
And they were really flabbergasted.
Yeah. At what point did Leith and I go with you to test the back seat? We didn't do it your test drive, but we went in, I think, just to kind of see how he could get in and out because we knew he'd be in the back. And
so that
salesperson asked about, like, do you need to bring your husband and let him see how it feels?
Yeah. And it might have been the same time.
Okay.
And I did look a mess, if you remember. I accidentally left the house in my Crocs.
Oh.
But still, like,
still. I mean, look.
Crocs doesn't mean you can't afford a car.
That's right.
Every car I've purchased since 2010 has been in my name.
Right.
Only.
Yeah.
Including this one.
Yeah.
So yeah, I did not. But I think he ended up calling and saying, my wife can buy this car. Please stop asking me to come.
I just can't. Yep. It is infuriating.
It really is. I mean, I do look youngish. I know that. But
right. I mean, yeah, they had your credit check. Yeah. They had your credit. They had all kinds of stuff that should say that you are worthy to buy that car. Anyway.
Yeah.
Dear listeners, that history is so pervasive because of what we're talking about. Because women were really non-legal entities for so, so long. We don't even realize it, right? That these things are ingrained in us. And then do you remember in the last episode, we talked about the slaughterhouse cases and Myra Bradwell, who wanted to be an attorney. Yeah. And so we had those justices talking about in slaughterhouse, the right to practice a profession, right? It's this fundamental right that states cannot infringe upon.
Absolutely.
Well, however, that did not pertain to women, especially in cases where we were concerned for women's moral and social exposure to problems. Okay. So it's not until 1976 that the courts allow women a little bit more freedom. But this case was specifically related to bartending. Mm-hmm. And so there was a Michigan law that said you could not bartend in an establishment unless it was owned by your husband or your father, because bartending could lead to these problems for women. And we were so concerned about them. So even though it's the 1870s that we're talking about your right to practice a profession, we still pretty significantly limited that for women up until the 70s.
And it's so interesting. And so in real terms, would it have been, I guess, illegal to hire a woman as a bartender?
That's a good question. I'm just not even sure that you would get the time of day.
Okay.
It was illegal. Specifically, this particular case came out of Michigan, and it was illegal.
Okay.
There was a specific law on the books prohibiting it. Now, in terms of if you get punished for doing it, I mean, somebody has to see it. Somebody has to say something. Somebody has to file a lawsuit. So, you know, we could talk about a lot of these things that don't ultimately end up in lawsuits because, you know.
Yeah.
So that's just a small sample of ways that being a non-legal entity can impact just your ability to do things that I think at this point we don't even really think about, right? We just go about our daily life and don't consider. Now let's sort of go back into the 50s and 60s. So as I mentioned, 1930s, World War II in the 1940s, things are happening, but we're not really in second wave feminism until the 1950s. And what happens is, as I think everyone knows, in the 1940s, during World War II, women were recruited to work in these positions that men who had left to fight had been in. But also, after the war, the economy was booming and we needed workers. A lot of women, too, that got to work outside the home in the 1940s discovered that they actually liked it. They actually kind of enjoyed doing something else. And remember, too, education rates are kind of slowly rising. So what was happening by the 1950s, we had a lot of women who were college educated, but then not utilizing those degrees. Mm-hmm. And so a few things that were occurring. There's a woman named Betty Friedan. Is that an author you have heard? She wrote The Feminine Mystique.
Oh, okay.
A really good book. Yeah, I highly recommend it. And in her book, she identified what she called the problem with no name. And I just think that's very poetic. And it's this issue of women were educated, they had worked previously, and they just didn't want to go back into the home. And there were spaces for women, especially related to clerical positions.
Mm-hmm.
And so between 1940 and 1960, the degree to which women entered the paid labor force doubled. I mean, women wanted these jobs and they wanted to be able to do some other kinds of work and contribute to their household. However, there were some problems. There were places that refused to hire women for quote unquote men's work. So if you think about like a store where you have to stock shelves, right? Something like that could potentially be considered men's work. Some companies took advantage of women's willingness to work part-time because that fit, you know, their schedule and without benefits. So we're going to talk about some of the issues related to a lack of benefits, but it really starts here that women were sort of so excited to get out of the home and they were willing to do that without benefits because their husbands had insurance or whatever. And then the issue of sexual harassment, which has always been an issue, right? But once you kind of start to see more women in the workforce, more issues start popping up. And so we're going to come back to that issue of harassment in a bit. So we've got women entering the workforce at unprecedented rates. The economy is able to support them. Then this sort of shift and change is also coupled with the civil rights movement. So we've got some changes happening in the economy, but then of course, politically and socially, the civil rights movement is ongoing. You know, really the catalyst for the civil rights movement is 1954, the death of Emmett Till. And so many women found their place in terms of their political voice in the civil rights movement. So remember we were talking in first wave feminism, it was abolition and temperance that really gave women a voice. And so you had Black and white women together really working towards racial equality and and sort of shifting how we handle race relations in this country. And so that becomes really important. You start to see big names giving speeches and just being out there. So those couple of things become really important in 1963, when then President Kennedy initiates the Equal Pay Act of 1963. And so we've got women who are seeing issues with paid labor, and they have more of a political voice thanks to the civil rights movement. And so they really push for these changes to the Fair Labor Standards Act. And this Equal Pay Act says that you have to have equal pay for equal work. So you cannot pay men and women different wages or give them different benefits if they are doing the same jobs or jobs that require the same skills and responsibilities. Now, in 1963, that was really specific to blue collar workers. It's not until 1972 that we update that to include what we would call white collar, sort of executive, professional, and administrative jobs. But as we all know, right, this did not solve the problem. But it was a good step in terms of at least raising the issue. But this will come back up in a minute when I talk to you about Lilly Ledbetter. So that's 63. 64, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 passes. And the reason I want to mention this is because it does two really important things. First, it does ban employers from discriminating on the basis of sex. It includes sex along with race, color, religion, national origin. But super important, a substantive impact of this law is the formation of the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And the EEOC becomes really critical in several of the stories that we're going to talk about. So first is they initially, they're formed and they make a ruling on sex-segregated job ads. And so if you look at old job ads from the 50s and 60s, you'll see, right? It's like women at this rate, men at this rate. And you'll even sometimes see similar jobs like clerks. We need a typist or whatever. And men are getting like 10, 20 cents more by the hour. And the EEOC in 1965 makes an administrative rule that says that sex segregated job ads are fine and they can continue. And this leads to the formation of a group that is still around today. And that's called NOW, the National Organization of Women. And their mission statement is to take action to bring all women into full participation in the mainstream of American society now, assuming all the privileges and responsibilities thereof in truly equal partnership with men. Sounds a little bit like some of the rhetoric we were hearing in first wave feminism, right?
Yes. And I think it's also interesting how that has continued. Like when we talk about men being allies in an equal things, it worked. And
Yeah. Because I mean, I think, spoiler alert, pay disparity is still a problem. And one way that you can remedy that is through this. So so the EEOC is important, as is the formation of NOW. So just a few things that NOW accomplished. I mentioned Alice Paul starts in 1923, pushing for the Equal Rights Amendment. That doesn't actually pass Congress until 1972, but NOW was very, very active. in pushing for it. Of course, it ultimately is not ratified by the states, so we do not have an Equal Rights Amendment. But after only 3 years, they were able to get the EEOC to remove sex segregated job ads. So you have to, if you have a job, you put it out there and everybody can apply. They also were instrumental in getting weightlifting limits removed for women. So again, I'm not just talking about like for firemen and things like that, which actually that's still an issue. But like just to be a clerk or whatever, you could have these weightlifting requirements for women. So they got rid of those. And then also in 1972, they were instrumental in the passage of Title IX, which is really important for women's sports, which is, of course, a big story right now as we talk about women's basketball. Right? So just a few things that NOW did. Like I said, they're still around today. They had some pretty heavy hitters in their organization for a long time. So if you think about the 50s, 60s, and 70s, we really had a ton of changes. Socially, politically, economically, culturally, right? So it was really a time of massive change in all aspects. There is a backlash to that, particularly by evangelical religious leaders. Some of our listeners may know Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and Phyllis Schlafly is kind of the big woman here, the face of anti-feminism. She founds a group called the Eagle Forum. And Phyllis Schlafly is really critical in pushing back against the ERA and pushing back against what we would consider second wave feminism, right? And in some of the derogatory terms that you hear a lot around this time, women as bra burners, feminazis, right? Some of these things. Yeah, there was bra burning, obviously, but
yeah.
So just prior to the election of 1980, religious leaders realized that they could join forces with conservative business interests and win. So they do. And so 1980 is the first time that we see that alignment with the Republican Party of conservative business interests and religious leaders that persists today. 1980 is the first time that happens. And so what's interesting is support for the ERA in the 1970s was across all lines, party lines, gender lines, racial lines, geographic lines. Like there was just broad support for the ERA. But by 1981, thanks to Phyllis Schlafly and her campaigns against the ERA, as well as others, basically support starts to divide along party lines. And there's another really great book out there called Why We Lost the ERA. And what's interesting about that is prior to 1972, when Congress passed the ERA, there were laws that were in place denying women the same access to jobs, et cetera, just like we talked about earlier, and did deny equal protection to men. But that changed with various Supreme Court cases, administrative rulings, and those Supreme Court cases were really big. So there were a lot of people by the 1980s that were like, oh, haven't we kind of fixed a lot of these problems? Like maybe it is fine and we don't actually need a constitutional amendment. So in addition to sort of the party division, a lot of the campaigning that you hear today with respect to the folks who are against LGBTQ plus protections, it's the same kind of rhetoric and verbiage that's happening here in the 1980s. So the ERA dies because it's not ratified by the state by 1982. We rock along. And at this point, second wave feminism is really sort of dwindling. You know, we got the Equal Pay Act, NOW had some successes. But it's just not that same kind of force that it was in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. But let's fast forward to 1991, when Clarence Thomas is appointed to the Supreme Court by Bush 41. Mm-hmm. And our listeners might not know exactly how federal judgeships work. And so basically, the president appoints the person, and the Senate confirms the nominee. There is an extensive investigation done on everybody. The FBI handles that. The FBI takes their findings and presents it to the Senate Judiciary Committee, where the hearings are. So anytime we have seen in recent years, like publicized hearings, that's coming out of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And then the committee votes, and then it goes to the full Senate for a vote. So when the FBI began their investigation into Clarence Thomas, they interview Anita Hill because she had worked for Clarence Thomas at the EEOC. Remember, I said the EEOC would become impotent again. she makes allegations of sexual harassment, and the report gets leaked. And once the report is leaked, their hands are tied. They, something has to happen. So that's when you see the very famous pictures of Anita Hill in front of a full Senate Judiciary Committee of all white men, led by Joe Biden, who has since said he regrets his role in this. And if I know for particularly our younger listeners, if you have not watched clips of this or watched the HBO dramatization, it is really worth a watch. It really laid bare misunderstandings about sexual harassment and misunderstandings about how someone might respond to sexual harassment. I would also say Apple TV's The Morning Show also deals with issues of this. So you can look up her clips. We won't talk about them here on the podcast, but basically the allegation was that he harassed her at both the Department of Education and the EEOC. And the senators just could not understand why she would possibly follow him to another job after being harassed. And she said, well, I wanted to work in civil rights, the civil rights division of the EEOC, which she ultimately did. And she also said that there was a time that she thought the harassment had ended only for it to pick back up. But the questions they ask are unreal. So I would encourage you to look that up. So I think everyone knows Clarence Thomas does, of course, end up getting confirmed. Anita Hill is doing great. She goes on to become a law professor. She's still around today. You'll see her being interviewed for various things.
I've seen her speak.
Oh, at Texas Conference for Women?
Yep.
Oh, God, I gotta go. God, I love the Texas Conference for Women. But here's why I tell this story. Is because after those hearings, you start to see women go, oh, yeah, this has happened to me. Like, I have been through this and I want to see things change. Mm-hmm. So those hearings were in 1991. 1992 was an election year. And 1992 is heralded as the year of the woman. So record numbers of women ran for office and won. And this is in both the House and the Senate, but it was a really big change in the Senate. So it was a lot harder for women, and especially women of color, to gain seats in the Senate. It's not until 1987 that we have our first female senator elected in her own right, not to take over, you know. And so, and some of them are still around today. Patty Murray is still around. You'll hear her talk. Dianne Feinstein was elected that time. She passed away recently. Yeah. But Dianne Feinstein did tell a great story about the first time she ran for office. She was running for city council and her children were teenagers at the time. And a reporter said, who's taking care of your children while you're out here running for office? And she said, their father. And also their teenagers. But anyways. And so that was pretty amazing. Women running for office and winning. And then Congress passed a bill that did give harassment victims the right to seek awards, back pay, and potential reinstatement. You saw women sort of getting the courage to file complaints. It could be really hard to file a complaint. We could talk about that in another episode.
Yep.
But complaints were up 50%. And then companies started doing training programs to deter harassment. And so I have to do one of these every year. So I imagine most of our listeners do. So what I like about that story is it shows you, right, whenever an issue that a bunch of people deal with is sort of brought to light, you can get a response, particularly, especially when it's something like this.
Mm-hmm.
The next one we're going to talk about, I would say, I don't know, maybe it's the same amount of impact, but that's the Family Medical Leave Act, Family and Medical Leave Act, or FMLA, passed in 1993. So again, this is happening because we've got all these women elected to office. And so a couple of things about FMLA for our folks who don't know. You do have to work in your job for a year, for at least 12 months, and you do have to work a little more than part-time. So the average is about 24 hours per week. And then the requirements, you can take up to 12 weeks in a 12-month period. You can use it for pregnancy, chronic medical conditions for you and your family. Sometimes military deployments, hospitalizations, there's a few little rules and requirements there. And so the perks here are that while you are on FMLA, your employer must continue your health insurance. it cannot be held against you for a promotion. And if you return within 12 weeks, you have to be returned to the same job, but it's unpaid. And many companies require you to use sick time, vacation time, personal time, whatever they call it, prior to your time off. So you got to use that up. So I think you have encountered FMLA before, haven't you?
I have. Thrice. So I warned Andrea ahead of time. This is where I had a lot to say. So
good.
My first time encountering and understanding FMLA was in my mid-20s. I had a friend and coworker who was pregnant, and she was explaining to me when she went out on leave. And keep in mind, I think we've talked about this before. I was not a person who babysat. Up until I had my babies, I was not a person who really liked babies or cared about babies just in general. I didn't understand them, didn't know anything about them. So she's talking to me about what this is going to look like for her, right? You know, she needs to work up until she gives birth, which is insane. Mm-hmm. So that could even happen at the office because you are working up until the minute you go in the hospital, because once you are in that hospital, this clock starts. Mm-hmm. And then talking about what that 12-week looked like, because just like Andrea said, it's unpaid. But the way that our company worked was they would pay 30%. You had to fund the other 70% with your time off. So while you are out of the office recovering from bringing a human into the world, you are using up your time off that you then need because you now have a baby who's going to be sick every 2 weeks.
Yep.
But not only that, is that you then have to come back and after 12 weeks. And that's most women, I don't think, even take that full time. So you're probably coming back somewhere in the realm of 6 to 8 weeks.
Right.
So one of the things I looked up, so you, if you haven't already thought about this, at some point in your life, you may need to.
Or they're baby adjacent.
Yes, true,
right?
Yeah. So as you create this human, your organs literally rearrange to make room. It takes 2 months for your organs just to go back to where they were. So your organs might still be displaced by the time you are returning to work. And there's a really great John Oliver. It's pretty old at this point.
Yes.
About FMLA.
Uh-huh.
And how, because this is unpaid, a lot of women need to get back to the office faster than 12 weeks, because not many people can go 3 months without income.
Mm-hmm.
Or they may not want to. There are women who are like, I actually am not enjoying this time and I would like to come back to the office. But then there's a whole nother slew. If you don't have family who will help with your baby, you need daycare or childcare. Mm-hmm. And most childcare facilities will not take a child earlier than 6 weeks.
Right.
So there is a period of time where, as the birth parent or the person who is acting as the birth parent, because obviously there are other things here. There could be adoption.
Yes.
And I don't think FMLA covers adoption, but a lot of companies now are having, they have an adoption policy, which is so important. Like, just spending time with the child, doesn't matter if you're the mother or the father.
Right.
People need to be spending time with the child.
Right.
But yeah, that was my first time really encountering what I felt like was injustice.
Yeah. Yeah.
So about this time is also when I started going to the Texas Conference for Women, which I went to every year for many years. It's a wonderful conference. I think it happens in October. If you are in Texas or want to go. And there was a lot of talk about, we need to be talking about wanting this leave and wanting better leave, which is very true. Like you were just saying, if we care about these things and voice our opinions, things can change.
Right.
Sometimes. But what people were really talking about is, you know, make sure you tell your employers. There are studies that indicate women are more productive when they come back from having these children. You know, so you can make that argument for why you deserve better leave is because you're going to do more. And what was so infuriating to me was the need to say, I'm going to work harder for you because you gave me something that almost every other country has already.
Right.
Yeah. And that almost every other country offers in a way that is a lot better than what we do. So this need to like prove that you're worthy, even though you had a child or adopted a child or in some way brought a child into the world.
Right.
It's just absurd to me.
Yeah.
So with my first child, I had to do the supplemental time off where I had to fund it with my PTO, et cetera. Luckily, he was born in November. So my PTO clock restarted while I was on leave. So I had a larger bucket to pull from.
Right.
Like, so if that's how your time off works and you're granted your time off, which most companies do now, because if you earn it, they have to pay it out when you leave or if you're let go. So, you know, you're granted it, say, on January 1st. So if you have your baby on January 5th, you have a full bucket for them to pull from. So that's kind of crazy. Then with my second, they actually improved the leave. It was at the same company. And I got 16 weeks and it was fully paid.
Oh, nice.
Then with my surprise bonus third child, I had been at my company for 4 weeks. So they were under no obligation to offer me FMLA.
Yeah.
I didn't know what I was going to do. It was all very surprising. Luckily, it was a Connecticut-based company.
Right.
Well, and they just said, don't worry about it. You're going to get 12 weeks paid. Yeah. And that went really far for me in earning my loyalty to that company for longer than I think it needed to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it is huge. And that's really unheard of.
Yeah.
I didn't have to do all the nonsense with the time off and whatever. And I just went. I just had a baby and I left.
Yeah.
For 12 weeks.
Right.
And so that was great.
Yeah.
So that is my personal experience with this policy.
And do you remember me telling you about when Montevallo was debating?
Yes.
So,
Yeah. Women are just going to start having babies because
they're going to take advantage. Mm-hmm. So they're going to take advantage of this policy.
Yeah. Which I love that. I love that in the 21st century, we think that women are just going to be gratuitously birthing children so they can get a little bit of time off.
Yep. Definitely. Especially in academia. Where you already get 4 months off a year.
Yeah.
No, that's just. Yeah, it was.
You know how women are.
Now, I will say, we did ultimately, this policy did pass. So we have a paid parental leave policy. Mm-hmm. It includes adoptions. It includes paternity leave, which I think is really good. But it is only 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And that was like, there was a time where people were like, 4 should be enough, right?
Yeah.
And somebody made the argument of like, you're not even healed. Like, if you have to have a C-section, like, it's a whole other issue. So anyway.
Yeah, I do think that all is really interesting, too. Going back to me saying I don't know anything about babies. When you think about what a baby can do between 4 and 12 weeks, it's nothing.
Yeah.
They lay there and they need you. They can't pick their own head up.
Right.
They can't hold things. Like, we're not talking about, like, a baby calf that can pop up right after it's plopped on the ground. Like, these are human babies are weak.
Yes.
They're worthless. You know, like, they're literally just, like, caterpillars. They just lay on the ground.
Oh. And that's it.
I know. It's honestly, it's the best time. Now I know.
Yeah.
Because then they start running and they get sassy. They roll their eyes at you.
But they're also hilarious.
So true. But okay, sorry. So that was a fairly long tangent.
Well, and here's what I'm thinking. Because the 90s gets us sort of to the end of second wave feminism and to the start of third wave feminism.
Oh.
So we could surprise third part.
Uh-huh.
Do a surprise third part and then do a 3 on the 3s at 6.
Oh, that's perfect.
Okay. So, yeah, we'll leave it with a very, very sad story of FMLA.
Yep.
And how it's still bad in 2024. However, it was something.
This
is thanks to women who said no more.
Yeah.
And tried to do something. So, well, so that's mostly second wave feminism. All right. Achieved it. Some downsides.
Mm-hmm. Mostly upsides, though. I mean, improvements. I personally love that I can buy a car, even if the car dealership doesn't like it.
It's true. Yeah, I guess because I am unmarried. And so I'm always like single. Nobody bats an eye to me. I'm like, one of those spinsters, eh?
You don't have to call dad, though. So there's that.
Yeah, well, that should start. Actually, if you that reminds me, our listeners may not know this, but our uncle died very unexpectedly in 2012, and our dad's only brother, and our dad was the executor and the beneficiary of his will. And for those of you who don't know our father, he hates paperwork and he hates humans, except for those he doesn't hate. And so in essence, we did everything together. And I just remember we had to go before the probate judge and I couldn't talk because I had no legal standing, you know?
Yeah.
And so I'm like whispering to dad, like, now you say this. And finally the judge was just like, okay, whatever. Like, who are you? Why are you doing this? So I have subsequently successfully talked our grandmother into making me the executor of her will. Just please. Let me be the legal, like, boss here because dad's just going to make me do it.
We could do a whole episode on wills and probate.
We sure could. Boy, could we. Who wants to hear about that?
Let's clap. That's everyone's favorite topic.
Mom would protest. Kalita.
I don't know what we're going to do with her.
Kalita's anti-will corner.
I know.
That's right.
If you don't have a will, you'll never die.
That's exactly right. And honestly, PK is just as bad.
It's true.
The two of them together. You know what? We're going to have some family time this week. Let's talk to them.
All right. Perfect.
Let's sit them down and say, we're not mad. We're just disappointed.
Just disappointed. Okay.
Well, a little bit. I love sharing a little bit from my little bit.
Yeah.
Sharing a little from my corner of the world with you. And I like hearing your stories, even when they're frustrating and annoying.
I do, too. I'm actually going to go and join now.
Oh, good. Yeah, I think that's awesome. All right. Well, I look forward to discussing third wave feminism with you soon.
Me, too.
All right. Love you. Bye.